good morning and welcome. Here in Philadelphia, as in any lodge, wherever in the world it is situated, and if you've never looked, you should look at the back of the periodical to see how many places in the world ULT is present. And while we're mentioning ULT, Wednesday night is a special meeting in commemoration and celebration of the work of ULT. It will be when our regular Wednesday night class would have been, from 7:45 to 9. And we invite you all to come to this devotional meeting. The work at each and every lodge is on the basis of the principles stated on the back of the periodical, the policy of the United Lodge. It is based on independent devotion, meaning that each lodge is autonomous, and each student or inquirer, visitor within each lodge is also autonomous. It is the individual deciding for themselves. The only real prerequisite is the acceptance that universal brotherhood is a fact, not a utopian ideal. It is a fact that must be realized and lived out. The work at this lodge is on Sunday mornings, obviously, and on Wednesday evenings. The Sunday morning program from 11 to 12 for the month of June has a topic heading of practical theosophy. And we may think today's title really isn't that practical, but the point is, it is practical, and we should start using it that way. The title this morning is Applying Correspondence and Analogy. And the last of the month of June, next Sunday, is Thinking with the Higher Mind. Starting in July, we'll be beginning our summer program. We will still meet on Sunday mornings. The new periodical is not here yet. It should be here by Wednesday night. On Wednesday, as we said, it's a special commemorative meeting. We have finished the Ocean of Theosophy for the year, and we will begin in the next week with the Bhagavad Gita, an introduction, and then we'll go through the book all the way through the end of September. The library will continue to be open from 5:30 to 7:30 on Wednesdays, and the work will continue to be done on the basis of voluntary donations of time and service and money. All are needed, and of course all are most welcome to attend. There's no obligation to anyone. And we remind you, one of our students has done a wonderful introduction card, and if you like, pick up several of them, take them with you, distribute them as you see fit. And we remind you that the Theosophical Independence, which is produced in-house for April and May, we're only running a little behind the world, is now available. So get it before June and July come out, and then you'll be behind. Now, our subject this morning, Applying Correspondence and Analogy. Well, we guess you'll have to wait and see how it's practical. We'll have a background of what the philosophy teaches about it, and then hopefully some indications on how to apply it.
We begin with a familiar refrain. Once upon a time, many, many years ago, somewhere around 3,500 to 5,000 years ago, depending on what you're reading, there lived a very wise man named Trismegistus, Hermes. They called him Trismegistus because it means thrice great, or three times great. It was written that, one, he was the greatest orator of his time. Two, the wisest of all philosophers. And three, the greatest Egyptian king. Perhaps, just perhaps, the prefix tri meant that he had been through three initiations in the ancient wisdom religion. Regardless of why he was called Trismegistus, the key here is his writings. And his writings on the Emerald Tablet, also known as the Smaragdian Table. Among other writings on this tablet were the following words as translated by H.P. Blavatsky. What is below is like that which is above, and what is above is similar to that which is below. Many notables from history have translated this tablet, including Isaac Newton and Apollonius of Tyana. So how do these writings on a tablet thousands of years old relate to today's topic? This ancient Hermetic teaching is part of the ancient wisdom religion. The law of correlation, or correspondence, as ordinarily understood, indicates the degree of identity between two or more objects, measures, categories, or sets of observations. To give you some examples of how you use this law without even giving it a second thought, I'm sure you're familiar with the correlation or the correspondence between a worker's wage and the price of goods. What about the correlation or the correspondence of weather conditions and the size of crop yields? Or of the correspondence of a poor diet and your overall health? Obviously, it is important to apply and see the results of these correlations to be able to extract data that is useful, measurable, and repeatable. And just as this law of correspondence works on the physical plane, so it works on the metaphysical plane. The law of correspondence, simply stated, says that we exist in all planes, astral as well as physical, or planes that appear to be independent of the physical. Everything that happens in the universe also happens inside of us. Emanuel Swedenborg, in 1758, popularized this ancient doctrine in his theological treatise, Heaven and Hell. He attributed present-day man's ignorance of this law to his separation from heaven by the love of self and of the world. And he adds, he who loves himself and the world above, everything cares only for worldly things because they soothe the external senses and gratify his lower mind. And he cares nothing for the spiritual things which please the internal senses and delight the soul. He therefore rejects these, saying they are too high for man's comprehension. It was otherwise with the ancients, for with them the knowledge of correspondences was the chief of all knowledges. By means of it also, they acquired knowledge and wisdom. But as this day, that knowledge is so entirely lost that it is not known what correspondence is. Swedenborg pointed out that the whole natural world depends or corresponds to the spiritual world, not only in general, but also in particular. This ancient law of correspondence and analogy was once again brought to our attention by Madame Blavatsky, who says that in occult sciences, this law is the first and most important key to the cosmic physics. Mr. Crosby writes, "The subject of the law of correspondences is a greater one than people are liable to suspect. Yet we all know something of correspondences in the simple facts of nature. The seven colors of the spectrum, the seven notes of the scale. Each color of each octave corresponds to the same color of another octave. We see only a certain number of rates of vibration, but above the number perceptible to us are those too fine for us to perceive with our physical senses. And also below are vibrations too coarse for our range of perceptions. The same is true with regard to sounds, from the note do up to T. Do corresponds to every other do in the seven octaves which we are able to perceive physically. But these seven octaves are merely a portion of the great octaves of nature above us and below us. There is a correspondence between the high and the low throughout all nature, because the great center of life, of consciousness, of perception, is the same in every being, of whatever grade, and because from within the center proceeds all action, the use of the power to act, which is inherent in that center, is the cause of all manifestation. In accordance with the various levels of reality, physical, mental, and spiritual, this relates that what happens on any level happens on every other level. This is, however, more often used in the sense of the microcosm and the macrocosm. The microcosm is oneself, and the macrocosm is the universe. The macrocosm is as the microcosm, and vice versa. Within each lies the other, and through understanding one, you can understand the other. During the Middle Ages, this principle was applied to alchemical experiments in an attempt to find the philosopher's stone, a substance that would turn lead to gold. This, of course, was the lowest interpretation. What the ancients really meant about alchemy. The correspondence behind their experiments was that just as man starts human life as an imperfect being, but purifies himself through many incarnations until perfection, metals could also be purified through many alchemical processes. The planets revolve around the sun, just like the electrons revolve around the nucleus of an atom. Every day, people wake up in the morning and go to sleep at night after a long, hard day's work. Just like we are born and die after an entire life. But just as the sun that rises again after a long night, and just as everyone wakes up after a good night's sleep, we are also reborn after death, according to the theories of microcosm and macrocosm. That is why the ancient philosophers taught that in order to understand the universe, one only needs to look inside oneself. And in order to understand oneself, one only needs to look at the universe. All things which are visible come from the invisible. In the evolution of a planet, there is a beginning in homogeneous radiant matter, such as composes the Milky Way. The basis of all subsequent forms that are brought about or produced by the beings who exist in that homogeneous state. But each being is a center, and each center is the same as the one great center. So proceeding from the same source, necessarily all beings proceed under the same laws. There is a correspondence between each being and every other being. As the theosophical method of education requires self-effort, individual initiative, patient search, and constant inquiry, test and verification, no statement is to be accepted on blind authority. Thus, every student, by close scrutiny of every observation and experience, should be able to see the validity of the law of analogy and correspondence. We are here for a great purpose. A great mission lies before every one of us, as well as great knowledge. We are here as knowing, self-conscious spiritual beings, buried in and identified with this body, with this matter. Involved in the very work we had to do on this plane of being, we have forgotten our own true natures. It behooves us to understand what our true nature is and to think and act in accordance with it. Understanding and utilizing the law of correspondence and analogy will certainly assist us with these goals.
Sigmund Freud said of analogies, they prove nothing, but they do make us feel more at home. It really is a comparison between two things to show their similarity. It's not an identity, it is a comparison. We use expressions like, it's the same as, it's just like, or you can compare this with this. It's no different from. It really is a simplified view, and we should keep that in mind. We shouldn't be thinking, well, I have to struggle very hard and be very brilliant and intellectual. It's just the opposite. It is to simplify and bring out an illustration, not a detailed examination of something, but something that illustrates the similarity. It's not a claim to total identification. That is a metaphor. A metaphor is supposed to represent exactly, but an analogy compares and shows a similarity. The really effective analogies are brief and are stated in a few sentences. But how do we, as we find ourselves right this minute, how do we try to learn to begin to apply analogies? Well, the first thing we need is an inquisitive mind. We should be looking at and questioning everything we see, everything we hear, everything we think we already know. We should be alert and responsive. And then we should seek to relate what we see and experience to what we know that we already know. And in that way, begin to see those similarities. Socrates asked a wonderful question. How can we learn anything, since in order to learn, we must inquire? And yet in order to inquire, we must know what we are seeking. But to know what we are seeking is already to know what it is we aim to learn. It's wonderful, isn't it? And that is what we go through. We have to be honest with ourselves, and if we're overhearing something or listening to something, like a lecture or reading a book, we have to say, I don't know what that word is. What does that mean? I don't know what that idea is you're expressing. How do I find out about it? If we're not honest about what we don't know, we can't be honest about what we do know. We have to admit, and it's not a crime or a failure to not know something. It just means perhaps we weren't paying attention the first time we came across it. We don't know about you, but whenever we ignore a new word, we're going to meet it three times in that week. So best to just face it and get it over with. Look it up in the dictionary or ask someone. But the important thing is not to try to please anyone else with what you're learning or what you're doing, but an open, sincere effort to understand for yourself. I want to know. I want to understand. So with this inquisitive mind, we then begin to really observe what is going on around us, in us, what we see in the life of others as well. If we use fresh eyes, and almost innocently, like a child, then we may discover some amazing analogies for ourselves. You know, Tai Chi Ono, who was the brilliant mind who put in the production of the assembly line for Toyota, making it the most successful car company. Well, he got his idea from a supermarket in the United States, watching them stock the shelves. And he applied that analogy to the car construction process. Also, he is credited for this wonderful idea to be able to instantly stop production if there's a problem. We assume it used to be complicated, foreman telling and people running around. His thing he got using the analogy of the cord that you pull on an American bus that tells the driver, I want the next stop. And he put that in his assembly line, and it saved a fortune in time and material. Older ones, the idea for the telegraph, and we don't understand this at all, was invented based on knowing how stagecoaches work. We guess it must be a system of relays or something. We don't understand. And Gutenberg's printing press, it was the analogy of a wine press. So these analogies can be made practical. That isn't our goal, but we can realize that it can be done. We want to understand. So using what you already know that does work, we can apply it and understand better how things work. Here's a few lyrics from a children's album called Ask the Planet. It's written to teach about biomimicry, and if you're interested, we have a lot of examples on it. The process of learning from and then emulating nature's genius, like studying a leaf to make a better solar cell, or studying an electric eel to make a better battery. Ask the Planet. These are children's songs. You got a problem? Are you having doubts? You got a question that you can't figure out? You'll find an answer, or two, or four. All you got to do is step out your door and ask the planet. Pose a question to a posy. Ask the planet. Don't worry, it won't think you're nosy. Ask the planet. Ask the ocean or the prairie. Ask the planet. Something scaly, something hairy. Ask the planet. It's been here a really long time. Yeah, the planet can help you with whatever's on your mind. And then an even better song. There's no such thing as garbage. Here we sit in primordial stew, doing what bacteria like to do. Although there are billions and billions of us, you will notice we don't make a muss, because there's no such thing as garbage. It hasn't been invented yet. There's no such thing as trash you stash and then try to forget. There's no such thing as garbage. We make what we need and no more. One critter's waste is another one's entree du jour. We are mammals and insects and amphibians, birds and reptiles and fungi. We've no need for landfills or stinky trash cans, because what one of us can't use, another one can. There's no such thing as garbage. We've been recycling all of our lives. One species' junk is another one's lunch and then becomes fertilizer. There's no such thing as garbage. We make what we need and no more. One critter's waste is another one's entree du jour. Now, about biomimicry, there's a wonderful book, Innovation Inspired by Nature, by Janine Benyus. And she says it's to learn from the world. How does the world, how does nature do things, and use that analogy to reproduce? Where did I put it? There's this wonderful, wonderful, here it is. Scientists at the University of Bonn in Germany studied how leaves, such as the lotus, managed to remain free of contaminants without the use of detergents. Actually, the leaf has a landscape of small bumps and waxy crystals, which cause water to ball up on it, and then the dirt particles teeter and are easily picked up by the water like a snowball lifting leaves from a lawn. The scientists worked out how to replicate that geometric profile of the lotus into commercial products, such as a building facade paint that exhibits a nano-rough surface when it dries. Rainwater cleans the building. Today, dozens of self-cleaning products, such as glass, roofing tiles, and textiles, bear the lotus effect symbol. So, analogy is alive and well and being used by brilliant minds. Why shouldn't it be used by ours? So, let's start applying analogy. Your questions are invited. Yes?
I think that one of the reasons we put so much emphasis on the fundamental principles of theosophy as being self-evident is because they're self-evident universal, we can then use them as our basis of analogy to proceed in everyday life. Mm-hmm. So we are already given that
foundation.
We have to understand it, but we're already given that.
But we're waiting for you to make an analogy of that.
One analogy that we were had immediately was the third fundamental, the idea that things begin within and from spirit, that everything we do begins in the mind. Well, you already know, do that. There's not a thing you've created that doesn't begin in the mind. But what we don't do yet is consider the ideas, the motives, the higher purposes that we want to put the things to that we create, do in this point. And we think that's...
And another thing we don't consider, usually, is you wouldn't build a house without a blueprint. It would not occur to you. And yet we don't create for ourselves an outline for the day that we're going to build. We just jump into it because that's what we think we should do. Yes?
So just to follow up on that's why the practice of meditation is an analogy to, in a sense, the way the universe begins in thought, in spirit, just like we
and centered.
And centered, just yes. Like we should begin our days centered in thought and spirit. That's meditation.
You know, some of the quote books that you can read, some of the famous thinkers realized that the whole basis for understanding anything is to realize that you are in the center of it, experiencing it, and you should be content because of that. The whole world is alive, and you're alive within it.
No comment.
No comment. Yes.
What
part does one's imagination play?
Oh, were you here last week? Imagination is very important. We can't make an analogy without using the power of imagination. It's the image-making faculty, and every one of us has it. We've just, well, perhaps we could say we've lost the use of exercising it. Yes?
Mm-hmm. It's possible that we're just unaware that we use it so much. Analogy is the basis for algebra. The entire ratio system of numbers is analogy. And poetry that we love so much in lyrics and songs, etc., mm-hmm. much of that is analogy and similes and metaphors. And something so concrete as law school uses analogies, Miller's analogies exams, in order to test somebody's intuitive ability to be able to analyze and draw conclusions and see the precedent and right. the actual new event.
But isn't it also to help them learn to do it? We know during the meeting on imagination, it was mentioned the Miller aptitude test, which had to do with analogy. And we failed totally. It was like a foreign language. But then after you think about it and you go back to it, you've developed some of the skill. But besides that skill, this, as a very simple thing, I mean, mundane things. I get up in the morning. What is that like for the universe? I'm supposed to be finding the similarity. When I get up in the morning, what am I doing that's similar to the universe? Yes.
There's an example on the internet right now, and some of the Philadelphia newspapers picked it up, of an image of a very, very bright star disappearing into a black hole way at the outer limits of what we can sense with our telescopes and whatnot. But there's a beam of energy that comes directly mm-hmm. back to the Earth. And we could use a picture like that, mm-hmm. couldn't we? To think about so many analogous realities of our perceptions on this planet.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
You said, what do you do when you get up in the world? Well, we wobble and the Earth wobbles.
I don't want to worry about the Earth wobbling. But what happens? It's an arising of consciousness. At least that's how we see it. But we're wrong. And we're wrong if we assume that about the universe. The consciousness was always present. It's just it wasn't present on this plane, in this field. So we awaken, all we really mean is we awaken to the physical. Yes.
Okay, we say the process of waking up is involution, and then we reach stasis, and then we try to evolve.
Yes, and try for evolution. Yes.
Well, there's an analogy between our waking up in the morning in this sense that we don't wake up and immediately begin to perform our activities and duties. We go through a preparatory stage mm-hmm. where we take on the clothes and prepare the instrument for the task of the day, just as the universe in those initial
right.
stages begins to develop the planes and the tools and the instruments that it will need to carry out.
We wake up as the perceiver
yes.
and immediately begin perceiving in the personal nature.
Follow up.
In the first presentation, correlations were presented as, at least as we commonly understand them, like one thing causing another. But for correspondence and analogy, it would seem that it goes beyond that, that it points to a higher reality of life than just one thing, you know, causing another. Could there be some...
Yeah, I did read some stuff on that, and it was saying specifically that correspondence was not cause and effect. Cause and effect is much wider, well, not wider, but more specific to a specific action. And correspondence is a wide brush in comparison.
Yes.
Tangential to the question about the role that imagination plays in making analogies, would it be okay to suggest that perhaps a minor yet incremental role in the whole process is also played by a sense of humor?
Oh, yes, we think absolutely, especially when you're making analogies that relate to your own behavior or understanding. We can't quote it directly, but HPB says that one of the prerequisites for being an occultist is a sense of humor. You can't do it otherwise. You're defeated before you start. Yes. I'm sorry.
That's all right. When I read the text of the Smarandine tablet or the Emerald tablet, the first thing that hit me talking about sense of humor was, it looks like this is the first 12-step program. And that it actually was a step program for alchemy.
I called on you way in the back.
We always, growing up, say you want an education, like we had friends who were in boarding school, and they studied the classics, and they all this literature from, you know, a long time ago. So when we became able, we began reading it, and we're going, what is the fuss? Why is this so important? And not until we came here did we understand that there's a story behind the story. Mm-hmm. And there's an analogy to all of that. So, I mean, education itself at one time was preparing us to develop that path, to live in a world where we used it more readily. So I think now we're seeing that the analogies that we see now are very materialistic.
If they even make them. I mean, if you read The Key to Theosophy, where HPB talks about what education was during her day and primarily still is, and what an ideal education would be. We are turning out commercial minds, people who can have the skills to work to make money. Yes.
Mm-hmm. The other analogy of, okay, when you wake up in the morning, it's a big analogy because everything, as we talked about some time ago, works in cycles. And this daily routine that starts with waking up and then going to bed and then so on, is our individual cycle. And there's the cycle of day and night and the cycles of the universe. All these cycles are all analogies.
Yes. Every as above, so below. That's Hermes. And we can see it, and then we can see it in ways we might not have realized. We can see it in the miniature in ourselves. You can clock your moods. You can clock your reactions because it is a definite cycle, just as much as Jupiter moving through the sky. Here comes your bad mood again. It's a cycle that you have created that you can register. Yes?
Just to go back to the comment about it being kind of a 12-step program, we couldn't help but notice, though, in the presentation from those tablets, how Hermes pointed out how we are
so infatuated and addicted to the sensations and the impressions they have on our lower minds. So it makes sense that we would develop a step-by-step program to free ourselves from that and find something higher to go on.
Yeah, the search, once they found the Emerald Tablet, it was supposed that it was strictly for alchemy, or for alchemists to follow those steps to convert lesser metals to gold, particularly lead. And the folks at the time with the wisdom realized that it was a step program for the purification and perfection of man. Yes?
Again, how do these three fundamental propositions, what is it about them that can help us understand the analogy of the correspondence?
Well, we would have to answer, understand everything, since they are the basis of the universe. What is the source of life? How does life work? And what is the purpose of life? If we don't have those answers, we can't use our imagination. We can't make a proper analogy. We need a foundation in those ideas first. Yes?
So, foundation of ideas, so that when we read the Bhagavad Gita, it's not just the words we read. Mm-hmm. There's an analogy, I think there's seven keys or seven analogies which can be an interpretation of that one writing.
Well, there's a wonderful challenge to every student of theosophy, and that's to find the seven keys. There are various hints throughout the secret doctrine, but if you begin to catalog them, you end up with about 25 keys, and then you try to figure out what is really being given to you. It's not an easy process. It's not supposed to be an easy process, because if we go back to Socrates, how do you search for something when you don't know what that something is? You have to use your mind to fix your mind. And you have to have a place to stand in order to do that. And that realization is that the mind is a principle that the thinker uses. We have the responsibility to study and understand ourselves and the universe, and to make the two meet in the mind.
I recently read in looking for material for correspondence that in the Bhagavad Gita, it's chapter 11 that specifically speaks of correspondence and analogy. I haven't looked further. I'm hoping to gain that wisdom when we start in 2 weeks to study the Bhagavad Gita.
Yes.
It's been said that we are given this philosophy not just for our own benefit, but trying to help on the problems that humanity deals with. So if we take a look at a very prevalent one, like the disparity and the conflict in the religions of the world and the adherence of those religions, how can we apply the idea of correspondence and analogy to trying to solve or approach those different religions from a perspective that isn't so stressful?
All right, what is it like that the difficulty and the contrast between religious ideas, what is that like? Yes?
Well, the first word that comes to my mind is reformation. And it's our understanding that Jesus, the Buddha, and the early teachers were reformers.
Right.
Rather than to bring a new...
But why is reform necessary? What is the problem? Yes.
Is it the difference between true ideas and false ideas?
Or the difference between fluid ideas and concrete ideas. We can liken it to within a family. You can have within a family very, very different opinions about certain things, and yet because there is that family feeling underneath it, a willingness to accept each other. What we find in the world is one group battling another group, and each group saying, we have the truth. You have to be either destroyed or altered because you don't have the truth. And that is the opposite of the way the soul makes progress. Okay. Yes?
I think this comment that they were all reformers. Why reform? Because religions classify. Today's Christianity is a long way from what Jesus taught.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Buddha taught, there are, I mean, how many different versions of Buddhism? To some degree, many religions calcified. They became institutional, and they had rules and rights and all that. And what we're doing here at the ULT is very similar. We're going back to
reforming, you mean, right? Not calcifying, right?
To the individual, to get away from the institutional
mm-hmm.
stuff. Because even theosophy
has happened too. Yes. Yes, it's that.
And what we are doing here is going back to the roots, to what
mm-hmm.
did they teach? What did HPV teach?
It becomes a personification of their leaders. And they personalize it. And they lose the true identity of the tenets upon which it was based.
Wait, Chase, following up on
that. There's another reason is that the ordinary men, the people, are looking for a structure.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people say, tell me what to do
exactly.
So I find the good.
That's the Gita. Arjuna keeps saying
and
that.
And these religious leaders provide this.
Mm-hmm. We want to be led. We want to be told. We want to be carried. We don't want to be independent.
If anybody knows the story of the Rhine Prison of Dostoevsky,
yes. Well, HBB did a translation of it
that
is absolutely amazing.
That's an absolutely amazing story.
Story, yes. If you're familiar with it, it's in the Brothers Karamazov. We think it's Pierre. The brother has written a story called The Grand Inquisitor. Perhaps.
I don't know which one.
The fact of the story is that this man is speaking within the church. And the Grand Inquisitor realizes that it's Jesus who has come to teach. So, of course, he imprisons him. And then he tells him why his ideas will never work for people. They cannot be given that kind of freedom. And
he did it all wrong. Jesus did it all wrong.
Yes, yes, you should have done this and this. The fact is, though, and we should remember, HPB was very strong about this, that it is the religious ideas, the dogma that is being challenged, and not the individual Christians, because there are many Christians who are better theosophists than theosophists, because they live up to the teachings that they have been given. So it isn't the individual members of a religion. It's the dogma that is in the control of that religion. Yes?
If we recall from the Gita, act as seem as best to thee. Well, it would seem that actions do speak louder than words. We receive the words and we begin to try to put them into practice. And there is where you run into a wall What does one who intends to put into practice these ideas, what is he to do when he does as seems best to him and there's a wall that they run into?
It's about convictions. Are you a person of your convictions, your beliefs, and are you willing to stand up for them? If you're willing to stand up for them, that those barriers are just mere nuisance. You continue, you go forth. That's.
Well, you know, Mr. Judge says. No, HPB says that someone could be in a prison and everything in the universe is working against them, and yet within their thinking, within their heart, they can remain true to the principles that they believe. So a wall doesn't mean anything except some garbage that you left behind. Every wall we meet in this life, we go back to those principles. Every wall represents something you did or didn't do in another life that doesn't leave you free at this moment. But your mind and heart remain free, so you can, as was said, remain true to your principles. Way in the back.
You're just thinking of a correspondence. The wall is held together generally by bricks and mortar, and when we heard the word mortar, we heard mort, which is to kill or to die. So the strength of holding that wall together is just how strongly we will kill out that desire to break through that wall until we pick up the hammer and begin the work of chiseling away. Because as was said, if that wall is held firmly in place, then the mind is not free to go beyond it, although we know it is. For the moment, that wall seems to be our block.
We could always paint a mural on it, make it more attractive than it is at the moment. Yes?
It seems that there's a correspondence, an analogy between the seven colors of the spectrum and trying to reconcile religions or the notes of the scale and trying to see the harmony of religions. They're all resolved back to either white light or a vibration, different degrees.
HPV speaks of that. She corresponds the musical scales and the colors of the spectrum. She says that red is do, orange is re, yellow is mi, green is fa, blue is so, indigo is la, and violet is ti. She also relates that to the seven principles of man. She says that red is the physical body. Orange is prana. Green is kama. Violet is the astral body. Indigo is manas. Yellow is buddhi. And blue is Atma. I hope I had them right. Yes?
But it would seem that these things could be stated, but unless we understood the keys, they would be too mysterious for us to begin to try to understand. We need to first try to understand the world. Make connections with what we see.
It's unlocking the seven keys in Isis.
We want to bring up something really kind of unrelated, except the mortar made us think of it. At the University of Manchester, they've invented a glue-free yet sticky tape that they modeled on the dry adhesion of the gecko. The gecko is able to hold on to something with a dry adhesion. So they now assemble products using gecko tape, and it can be removed without any adhesive contamination. So the processes that we see and hear about, like the ones, the correspondences we just heard, to us, they don't relate to anything in a practical sense. And yet, if we were to walk around and hold those ideas in our minds, like these scientists, we might see something that we didn't know we knew. We have to remember, as was said earlier, perhaps Hermes was tri because of three previous initiations. We have to remember, we have no idea over 18 million years what initiations we have been through. And the wall in front of us relates directly to something we have to figure out so that we can go on. In the current magazine, Theosophical Movement, the May issue on the book table, there's a wonderful analogy. A child playing on the ground looks up at something that the mother is embroidering. And he says to her, "That's ugly. The whole back is nothing but knots and mixed up colors, and that's ugly." And the mother says, "Come sit on my lap and see the design." What looked to be only a jumble of threads from the ground turned out to be some beautiful pattern when looked from the mother's side, because the mother was following some design as she embroidered, which the child could not see. That is exactly how we feel when we see our life from our side as God or law embroiders our life. We question the choice of colors and ask for more of brighter colors and so on. But if we could only look at things from the point of view of the divine, we would find order and pattern and appreciate that there are no accidents in life nor a misshapen day. So we don't understand the wall, but we should respect it. Yes?
And as a little note on that, wall climbing is an art. And if we look in our knapsack, we'll find ropes, and we'll find what they call
pinions.
Which, and I have it. And we can climb it. We just have to use our imagination and see what we already have.
Well, we think you're very fortunate to have come with a knapsack full. Some of us don't have that. But a wall is not such a bad thing, because you may have been speeding off in a direction that would have been very bad for you. And a wall prevents you from going any further. So.
And there's also going around it. You don't have to go through it.
Or tunnel.
Or tunnel.
Tunnel under it.
You know, I want to get back very quickly to the relationship of the colors. That's all depending upon frequency, vibrations. So the vibrations, how quickly one thing vibrates, depends upon a sound you hear of that vibration or the color you see from that vibration, and they all relate to each other, including colors of the zodiac.
Yes.
So by the very word that you are speaking, you are setting up a vibration.
Mm-hmm.
If we were as a song, we could see the colors of your speech fill the room. So,
yes.
I guess we have to speak with love and caring.
Yes, this came out last week during the imagination talk. We color the world all around us, the walls, the floors, the people. And when we prepare a meal, we color the food with our level of feeling. And therefore, anyone who partakes of it is colored by that. So we have a serious responsibility. Life is a wonderful adventure, and we're here to share it with each other. But we have to remember our responsibility in it. We remind you that Wednesday night is quite literally a devotional celebration of ULT. Meeting is adjourned.